Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Find us on BitChute at Talk Digital Network. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Both the bulls and bears ended up unhappy by the end of the week. He checks out the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Founder of the website dollarcollapse.com, John Rubino, comments on the financial headwinds Europe faces, the Fed's over-eagerness to raise interest rates, and how uranium might be the hottest commodity play. Founder of Ross K. Home Ownership Advisors, Ross K., gives us his take on the declining Canadian real estate market and blows up some of the myths people might have about how the real estate bubble happened and when it might have started deflating. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, recycling trade publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Nice to be back, Jim.
Ross, was it a rocky week on the stock markets?
It was one of those weeks where the bulls and the bears both got thrashed here. The early part of the week, we had finished off the previous week with a pretty good strength, and that we had followed through right into Monday, and then guess what? After a nice 50 or 60% retracement rally off the summer highs, the market ended up falling apart from the last 3 days of the week. So in general, down about 4.5% across the board this week. So what you've got is, a downtrend with sharp rallies within it, since the better part of November. The last rally now being the one that topped out in the last 4 or 5 days here. That'll be the one that we have to keep an eye on. Sentiment a week ago was reaching extremes, and I think that little rally that we had, I call it a little bit, was pretty good in terms of magnitude. That did a bit of a clean out, and the movement back down to new lows for the last month is probably going to bring back a bit more of a negative sentiment, but you're going to have to take out that June low, I think, to really put the fear into people. And, when you look at the various indices, that's probably in the cards as we move through September, October, which are, typically some of the poorest months that the market has seen or has seen historically.
What's going on the currency front? The U.S. dollar kind of treading water, but a couple of other currencies caught an anchor.
Yeah, the U.S. dollar, it had a decent correction into Monday, Tuesday, but still within that just methodical uptrend that it's got. Support at 108 on the index, closed back at 109.5. And when you take a look, north of the border, Canadian dollar had just a terrible week at 75.30 on the currency, and this is as methodical on the downside as the U.S. dollar is on the upside. Probably getting towards the bottom of a channel right now, maybe there's a bit of a bounce in the cards as far as the Canadian is concerned, but probably just that. Maybe something up around the 76.5. Lots of overhead resistance up there. You take a look at something like the British pound down now to 114, even weaker in general than the Canadian dollar has been. And, an overview, we've been looking for, a strong U.S. dollar for the last couple of years with just corrections along the way. At this point, a correction in the U.S. dollar might take us back from to the 106 level. There's a 20-week moving average sitting right about there. We have got monthly upside exhaustion readings on our index, so the probability of a 3 or 4 point correction is a possibility. So don't be overly committed to either side of the market right now. If you get the correction, buy into it. If you get through 110, you probably want to take some money off the table if you've been enjoying this ride on the upside.
What's going on with gold and silver?
So a week ago, we had some really bullish numbers for silver as far as the commitment of traders are concerned. The commercials were net long. We've only seen that twice in the last 30 or 40 years. And so with that, you had a really sharp rally, and the gold came along for the ride, but both of them peaked out early in the week, and the commercials now are back net short again, about 3,500 contracts on the silver market, so we took care of that excess. But silver as a whole is holding up much better than gold. You take a look also at something like platinum, palladium, those are, on the industrial side, looking pretty good in here. So for the precious metals as a whole, still too early to say that the gold market is finding a bottom, but I think that silver, which closed off the week around 1930 on the futures contract, 1937, good support there at 18. And as long as it can hold those corrections and maybe get through 20, which would be up through the 20-week moving average, that would be a catalyst for probably a better run on the upside.
What's going on with crude?
In terms of energies, the rallies there, once again, running out of steam with just about everything else, $85 on crude. The trend, you take a look at it, was just so solid on the upside up until the end of June. And then we failed at the 120 range, and sort of a double top up there. And at this point, trend is starting to just become methodically down. We get 4 or 5 day recovery rallies and then new lows. And as of the end of this week, trend is down. It's going to take a move, I think, to close above 90 to be a catalyst as far as the getting that market going. We had been looking at the fact that the stocks had been outperforming significantly versus the bullion, the oil market itself, and that's what we had seen at a couple of the other important tops in the last 2 decades, where the institutions get a little too bullish on this tail end of the move. And right now, I'd like to see maybe a bit of a clean out here before we get a substantial rally as far as crude's concerned. Nat gas had a pretty good bounce early this week, rallied from the 770 range up to 9, and then back down to test support at the end of the week. This is all in what is historically the low period of mid-August through mid-September, where you put in a base and then put in some kind of a decent rally through in September into October, with a possible second rally into November. So we're going to watch this that gas market and see how well it holds in. The stocks there, like Chenier, LNG, holding up reasonably well. So you can take a look at buying those gassy stocks on a pullback.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, John Rubino next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website DollarCollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Port Angeles, Washington. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim. Good to be back.
John, Europe is falling into an inflationary depression. How did they let this happen?
Europe has been making mistakes on the financial side of things for decades now. But the latest one is the worst, and that is they screwed up their energy system, which we really don't have time to go into the whole set of mistakes that they made in that area. But suffice it to say that they don't have enough natural gas or electricity in general to get through the winter without serious disruption. So they're looking at major industries just closing down and people not being able to heat their apartments or take hot showers or anything through the winter. Responding to that, European governments are looking at some pretty big bailouts right now, where they step in with, you know, an aggregate of $1 trillion and bail out all the industries that would otherwise go bankrupt and keep voters from rebelling with some kind of stimmy check related thing. And it's going to cost a fortune to stave off an inflationary depression in the coming year, which they may not be able to do under any circumstances, but the amount of money that it's probably going to require is going to seriously weigh on the euro. That's why it's already down to parity with the U.S. dollar from considerably higher a year ago. And so it looks kind of like a no-lose situation right now for them. They either try to rein in their money printing and allow a bunch of major industries to just vaporize, or they bail out those industries at the cost of a crashing currency. It doesn't look like there's really an easy middle way out of it. So Europe could be front page news in the coming year for all the wrong reasons.
The U.S. dollar is spiking versus the euro and yen. Is a too strong currency a problem? And if so, why?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that we've had going on 10% official inflation this year, which is to say the dollar's lost 10% of its value. And yet, it's a strong currency relative to the world's other major currencies, which says less about the U.S. than it does about the other countries with major currencies. And we've already talked about Europe, but the yen, the Japanese yen, is also way down versus the dollar because Japan is this absolute financial basket case now. Their government is more indebted on a per capita basis than any other government in the history of the human race. They're having to keep their interest rates at near zero while most other central banks are raising interest rates just because the Japanese government would go bankrupt if it had to pay interest rates on its debt comparable to what the U.S. pays, for instance. And because they have to keep interest rates artificially low, that's making the yen less attractive to investors around the world. And the yen is crashing. It's about 140 to the dollar right now after being about 105 to the dollar a year ago. So that's a major crash. That's a nearly 40% decrease vis-a-vis the dollar in just a year. And again, no end in sight for Japan either. But the fact that the dollar is this strong versus other currencies, you know, it looks like kind of a vote of confidence, but it's actually a big problem for us in the U.S. because it makes our exports much more expensive. So anything we want to sell to the rest of the world, anything our multinational companies are trying to sell around the world, it's all priced in dollars, which are appreciated versus these other currencies, which means it's basically a big price increase for these companies trying to sell this stuff, and that's not good for our big companies. So it will lead to lower corporate profits in the future and a slower economy, and it'll exacerbate what might be a big recession already coming in the next year.
those trillion-dollar bailouts of European energy and manufacturing companies already in the works are affecting the euro. How far do you think it might plunge?
Well, you know, there's really no end in sight for how far the euro could go, because it was already kind of a doomed currency before all the latest batch of things happened, because they, when they set the euro up, they required everybody within the eurozone to use it, to get rid of their original national currencies and use the euro, but they didn't create a centralized budgeting process. So basically, Italy could still run the deficits it wanted to run, France could, Greece could. And so the weaker countries in the eurozone continued to borrow insane amounts of money at very low interest rates, because they were borrowing in euros, and everybody in the world basically thought euros were German currency. You know, they thought Italian bonds were basically German bonds. So they were willing to buy Italian debt at really favorable interest rates for Italy. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank was buying most of the bonds that were issued by the weaker eurozone countries in any event. Now, put all that together, and you get a system that's inherently unstable. The weaker countries continue to build up more and more debt, which will eventually blow up on them and make it impossible for them to live under a euro standard. Because traditionally, somebody like Italy would run up huge amounts of debt, then just devalue the lira, and then go back to square one and start borrowing again. But they can't do that under, you know, the relative strict regime of the eurozone. And that was going to blow up the common currency eventually. You know, the euro was going to fail because some countries just couldn't live under that kind of discipline. Well, now it's much worse. So with an energy crisis and Germany no longer the rock-solid AAA credit that everybody thought it was, and the European Central Bank continuing to create massive amounts of new currency, all that stuff going on is going to put additional pressure on the euro and bring the eventual dissolution of the common currency further up in time. So it could happen a lot sooner than it would have otherwise.
How much longer can the Fed tighten into all this chaos?
Well, now there's the big question, because the Fed is going to tighten at its next meeting. They've already pretty much guaranteed that. The only question is whether it's 75 basis points or 100 basis points. And they're doing that because we've got, as I mentioned, raging inflation still in the U.S. You know, if you've got 8 to 10% official inflation, the central bank has to raise interest rates. You know, it has to tighten. There's no way around it. But it's going to be tightening into an incipient recession around the world. And one way that you know this is true is to look at what FedEx just said today. Federal Express, the big package delivery company, they came out and they withdrew their year-ahead earnings guidance. And the CEO said that a global recession was imminent, because they're seeing this huge slowdown in package delivery volume, and that's basically a vital statistic of the global economy. You know, that's a sign of the relative health of manufacturers and banks and things like that around the world. And for package delivery to slow down that dramatically implies to at least the CEO of FedEx, and I think correctly, that the global economy is slowing down. So we could already be in the beginnings of a recession. You know, in the U.S., we've already had two quarters of slightly negative GDP growth, but that's probably not the end. We could be heading into a couple or three or four quarters of dramatically negative GDP growth. And for the Fed to be tightening into that will just make the slowdown that much more dramatic. And, the takeaway from all this is that central banks can't predict what's going to happen. They have no idea what they're doing in the moment, because the results of whatever it is they do don't show up for 6 to 18 months. You know, you have this big lag between a change in monetary policy and its effect on the real economy. So the Fed is always operating with a high degree of uncertainty. And add that to the fact that their models are flawed, and that they themselves, the guys running the Fed, are just, you know, morons. Let's be honest. They just do not know what they're doing. Even if they had good models, they still probably wouldn't know what they were doing.
Someone once described the Fed to me as driving a Porsche down the freeway at full speed, but steering, looking into the rearview mirror.
Yeah, and now add to that that the person driving has a driver's license from a fake mail order school. They've never actually been tested. They really don't know how to drive the car. Then you pretty much got the picture. So, it's not a surprise that the Fed is tightening into a recession, because they tend to do that over and over again. And the difference being that this time we don't just have an inflation, a recession going. We've got pretty dramatic inflation at the same time. We've got messed up supply chains all around the world, and we've got extreme geopolitical stress out there. So monetary policy is almost the least of our problems, but it is a contributing problem to some very big, very nasty thing that's coming our way.
Everyone's restarting or building nuclear plants. Does that make uranium the best commodity play?
Yeah, now this ties into the energy crisis that we talked about earlier. Basically, the current energy infrastructure in Europe and also in other parts of the world is inadequate to handle power demand. And one of the reasons for that is because a lot of these countries closed down their coal-fired plants and their nuclear plants prematurely. They thought they could shift completely to solar and wind just immediately, just by willing it. But the technologies aren't quite there yet. So they end up with a system that's inadequate, and a lot of them are restarting their coal plants, they're restarting their nuclear plants, and importantly, they're announcing new construction plans for nuclear plants. I forget who it was. Was it Japan? Anyhow, somebody just announced they were going to build, oh no, it was China. They're going to build 10 new nuclear plants per year for the indefinite future. And with lots of other countries doing something similar on a per capita basis out there in the world, the demand for uranium to run all of those nuclear plants is woefully inadequate. We just do not have the mine supply of uranium right now to cover the demand that's likely even just a few years down the road, let alone a decade down the road. So what that means is we got to get more uranium from somewhere. And since all the economic mines are pretty much running right now, we're going to have to go to uneconomic deposits, which is to say more expensive deposits. And for those to be economic, the price has to go way up. So we pretty much have to see the price of uranium rise in order to make all the moving parts of this story fit together. And right now, uranium's up fairly dramatically from the past year, but it was really depressed a year ago. And same thing with the stocks of the uranium miners. A lot of them they're up, but they're up from fairly low levels, and they're nowhere near where they're going to end up if uranium prices go where somebody like Rick Rule at Sprott Asset Management thinks they're going. So I think that makes uranium one of the really interesting commodity plays going forward, because so much of the story is already baked into the cake, you know? It looks like nuclear plants that have been mothballed have to come back online, and it looks like new nuclear plants have to be built, and there are these new modular nuclear plants that are smaller and mobile. You know, you can put them wherever you want them, and they generate electricity for an office complex or a small town or something like that. So that's a new source of uranium demand that was going to come in any event. So you put all that together, and you have a pretty dramatic increase in uranium demand, uranium pricing, and the value of the companies that have uranium in the ground. So I think they're along with gold and silver. Uranium companies and gold and silver miners are probably the three most interesting commodity plays out there right now.
Mm-hmm. Gold and silver is still weak in U.S. dollar terms, but they are moving into positive technical and seasonal territory. Will the next 6 months be better than the last six for gold and silver?
Yeah, they should, for several reasons. One is, like you said, seasonal. You know, normally gold and silver are weak and boring during the summer, and then they start to pick up in the fall, and then they really rock in the winter. And that's because of Asian demand. Asians like to give gold and silver jewelry as wedding gifts, and in order to turn gold bullion into gold and silver, jewelry. You have to buy it in the fall and then give it to jewelers who then create the jewelry. So that creates demand for gold and silver towards the end of the year and early in the next year, and usually leads to prices going up. So that's just kind of a normal thing. And at the same time, you've got the prospect of the central banks of the world recognizing that they've engineered a recession that's so severe it's going to get away from them, and shifting back into easing, which is going to happen in the year ahead, you know? So I think by the end of this year, it should be becoming obvious to people that the global economy is slowing down, and speculation should be rising that the Fed and the other central banks are getting ready to shift gears and start easing again, or at least stop tightening. And that normally lights a fire under precious metals. So we could have two things at once happening, where we've got the imminent arrival of easy money combined with good seasonality to produce a really nice move in prices for those things. So I think we could, early 2016 is a long way in the past. Most people don't remember it, but we had just a spectacular few months in gold and silver. And I think we could see something like that again in January and February of this year, just because so many good things are coming together for precious metals.
Shades of the Hunt brothers back in the late 70s, some are predicting a silver short squeeze. Is this possible?
Yeah. Now, what that means is that a lot of the available silver on the metals exchanges is being bought up and taken elsewhere. You know, either investors are buying it, or central banks are buying it, or industrial users are buying it, whatever. You know, there's enough demand right now that it's soaking up the available supplies to the point where they're not adequate for the demand that is projected for the next 6 months or a year. So it could be extremely tight supplies leading to the kind of price instability that that you get when you have shortages. And meanwhile, you've got a lot of people short silver in the futures market, and that could blow up on them, force them to close out their shorts at much higher prices, and that's the short squeeze you were talking about. So that's also possible, and it could be triggered by the rising prices that normally flow from just good seasonality right now. You know, if you get dwindling supplies as prices are going up, driven by higher demand, and you get the potential for upside instability, and we could see that with silver. It's such a tiny market. Let it begin a run, which leads to a short squeeze, and $50 silver is easy. You know, that is it's something that could totally happen in the space of a few months. But I think the ultimate high for silver is much higher than $50 an ounce, but $50 is something that we could see sometime in the next year easily.
Are U.S. stock markets looking bullish or bearish heading into 2023?
Well, they went down again today, U.S. stocks did. And the reason that they've been having a hard time lately is that we got this destructive combination of things going on from the point of view of stock investors. One is that the Fed is tightening monetary policy. And that's a bad thing. Normally for stocks, and almost always and everywhere, it generates a bear market when the Fed tightens aggressively. And the other thing is that you've got extreme instability in the world. Like I was saying, supply chains are a mess. Geopolitics is absolutely crazy right now. We've got the U.S. kind of picking fights everywhere around the world. We've got Russia, Ukraine, really nowhere near the end, and maybe entering a more dangerous phase as Ukraine counterattacks, and Russia has to decide what to do about that if it's going to, step up its aggression. And there's lots of uncertainties in the world that would normally weigh on stock prices. But in an easy money environment, the liquidity offsets geopolitical turmoil. But now we've got tight money and diminishing liquidity and geopolitical turmoil, and that's a whole different story. So, yeah, I think that U.S. stocks are very precarious right now, and they could easily drop 30 or 40% from here and still be kind of fairly valued given the world the way it is. But keep in mind that, like I said, looming out there is the Fed's pivot from tightening to loosening. And when that happens, stocks usually respond favorably. So, you know, I'm short a lot of things right now, but, if you do something like that, you have to understand that this thing can turn on a dime. You know, maybe Russia and Ukraine cut a deal and the Fed announces that it's done tightening, and that happens in 1 week, you know, and the stocks will respond favorably to that. And you don't want to be terribly short when that happens. But in the meantime, shorting is probably a profitable strategy just because U.S. stocks are, they're more biased to the downside than to the upside right now, for sure.
A significant part of the economy for Canada and the U.S. is real estate. What predictions are you hearing for the housing market?
Oh, real estate is just toast right now, to put it bluntly. We've been raising interest rates in the U.S. for quite a while, and the 30-year mortgage has gone from 2.5% to 6%. That pretty much doubles the monthly cost of a mortgage in the U.S., and it makes houses that were already unaffordable, completely unaffordable. You know, there's not even a chance of you getting that house you had to stretch for when the mortgages were 2.5% if you have to pay 6% on a mortgage today. So what we're seeing in the U.S. is a massive increase of houses for sale. For a long time there was no inventory. If you wanted to buy a house, there were like three that you could look at in your area and in your price range. And now they're everywhere. I think it was Phoenix. I might be wrong about this. Maybe it's Las Vegas, but I think it was Phoenix that saw something like a 177% increase in housing inventory year over year. In other words, there's more than twice as many houses for sale right now as there were a year ago. And the reason for that is because nobody can afford them at last year's prices. So we're going to see prices stabilize in some places and drop hard in other places, and that's going to be another drag on the economy because the housing market is huge. And for it to turn negative almost guarantees that overall GDP is going to be negative. So add in, you know, the trouble with FedEx and package shipping and our energy crisis and a labor market that is strange, to put it mildly, and then housing going down, and you got the makings for a pretty slow economy going forward. You know, whether it's a deep recession or just something like what we have today, where it just kind of crawls along with nothing much happening of note. You know, there's no way to know ahead of time, but I'd say the odds are that it's both very weak and very unstable in the year ahead, just because we've got so many other risks out there besides a slowing economy, and they can kind of feed on each other. And I think that's probably what we're going to see, and housing is probably going to be a big component of the negative news that comes out of the year ahead.
Are any of the junior mining sectors looking good right now?
Well, yeah. If gold, silver, and uranium are going to go up, then the valuations for the underlying miners or the related miners will probably be pretty positive. You know, if silver were to go from the, you know, $20 U.S. right now to $30, let's say, that's a 50% increase. But you could see the silver mining stocks double in that kind of an environment from here on average. Same thing with uranium and, to a lesser extent, gold. And that wouldn't really take too much from here to have that happen. So I could see a lot of the junior precious metals miners double from here. And that's just the beginning. You know, nothing goes in a straight line, but I think irregularly over the coming decade, you're going to see these things just rock. They're going to be one of the best sectors to own, precious metals miners. And the higher quality ones will be 10-baggers from here.
Are junior mining stocks more popular now than they used to be in the U.S.?
No. They are as out of favor as they've been. Well, okay, as out of favor, yeah. They're pretty much tied for being as out of favor as they've been two other times in the time I've been watching them, in 2008 and in 2020. Both times, they were incredibly cheap. And both times they took off from a V bottom and had a spectacular run from there. And this feels like that again, with the addition of crazy Fed right now, tightening and everything, but that'll end pretty soon. And when it does, you'll see these incredibly unpopular stocks get much more popular. But right now, they're so out of favor, that, at least based on their price action, that it's like nobody likes them. Not even just some people, but no one likes these stocks right now, which is traditionally the time to be buying them. And, you know, I'll say it. I'm continuing to add to my junior mining positions, with the expectation that, half of them go out of business completely and the other half go up by 5 or 10 times.
What are the biggest wins you've had in junior mining stocks?
Well, haven't been too many lately. I've been kind of coasting on Great Bear Resources for the last couple of years. Great Bear is a Canadian miner that just did everything right. They found an epic deposit and explored it systematically, without leveraging themselves to the hilt or diluting their stock or anything. They just methodically went about figuring out what they had, and it turned out to be a lot, and they sold out for maybe 40 times what they were 2 years before they sold out. That was a nice run, and that's the kind of thing that is very addictive. Once you've experienced something like that, you know, a 40-bagger, you want that feeling again, and you're really favorably predisposed to little exploration companies with that kind of a profile. Now, there are a lot of them out there that have that profile, but none of them have had a run like Great Bears yet. The only one that's done pretty well lately is Snowline, which is a little gold miner, a little exploration company that has reported some spectacular drill results and looks like it's delineating a really impressive resource that some big miner will be happy to buy for a nice premium. There are a lot of other miners out there with interesting profiles, similar to Snowline's, but they just haven't had their runs yet. So I think, a portfolio of the five companies that look like Snowline does today would be a really nice speculative portfolio. I think it's one that's, that could easily, in the aggregate, be a 5-bagger, if not a 10-bagger.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Sure thing, Jim.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. Our conversation took place on Friday, September 16th. Coming up, Ross Kay, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Ross Kay, founder of Ross Kay Home Ownership Advisors, online at rosskay.com. Ross, it's been a while. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Ross, how are things going at Ross Kay Home Ownership Advisors?
Pretty good. You know, been a long wait since 2015 for all the stars to align properly and for policymakers to establish the policies that would prove that our understanding of housing markets are true. So, yeah, it's pretty good here.
In July of 2021, what signals did you see in Canadian real estate?
Well, our signals really started in April of 2021. Jim. Because we measure housing markets differently, our metrics are recording things so far ahead. So even though we made a formal call in July of 2021, that was 3 months after we issued a warning, on the market. So you issue a warning the way that we do things. Okay. We issue a warning and then if we don't see any changes in the following 2 months, on the third month, we actually make it an official call. So what I'll tell you is that the signals that we're reading have never reversed in the 40 years our data covers, but we're so far ahead of the market, Jim, that we have the freedom to take that extra 3 months just to make sure there's no anomalies in the data. So if you go back to the show September 28, 2021 that I did with you, you guys probably still have in your archives, you'll see that I laid out a scenario from a February of 2021 till July of 2021 or August 2021, a scenario. Well, that scenario was the scenario we were reading a year in advance. So we knew what was going to happen with peak price in Q1 2022, but we also knew all the damage that would have been done to people who were buying out. So for the free advice that we gave on Howe Street, we told that story, knowing that although it would take a few months for us to be proven correct, in this case it was about 8 months, we also would have maybe stopped some families from making a tragic, life-altering financial decision, really. So if you go back to that show, September 28, 2021, and you listen to our commentary deciding the peak of April 2021 through till July, you're going to hear the exact precise thing that was recorded everywhere else in 2022. Same timeline, same everything.
With rising inflation and rising interest rates, some economists are now predicting a crash landing instead of a soft landing for the Canadian economy. What could this mean for real estate?
Well, I would argue the reverse is how we see it, Jim. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's we just look at this just the opposite. We believe it's the housing market that leads the economy, not the economy that leads the housing market. So looking at the housing market, we see that it's now been in a contraction now for over a year. It's been a correction now for months. And we believe that the economy eventually will record this, as it has every time that this has happened in the past. So we really don't believe that the economy is going to have an impact in the housing market. It's the opposite way around. It will become self-fulfilling, I guess, to a certain degree, because the bank has been foolish enough to continue to raise rates instead of letting things work out over time. And they clearly misread inflation, because our inflation measures, we recorded rising inflation Q1 2017. We knew that we were going to get rising inflation because the mortgage qualification rate was enacted in that first quarter. So we recorded rising inflation as of that date, and that inflation on a trend has been rising nonstop. It wasn't that the bank magically decided or magically came out and said, oh, inflation is rising, now we've got to raise rates. This was something you should have saw way back in 2017, because you can't say we're the only people that saw it coming.
How high do you think interest rates could go?
Well, I think they're already too high. I don't care what anybody else says. What I think is that we should have had continually preset a series of rising interest rates at 0.25%. They should have, that he's already raised it, this shouldn't have taken place until probably around by 2028. It should have been a gradual progression, giving Canadians advance notice that rates were going to go up. They could book their mortgages. They could set up their lives on a continually rising interest rate scenario based on predetermined interest rate increases. But, of course, that didn't happen. So I already believe rates are higher now than they should be at this time. How high could they go? I believe that the Bank of Canada will continue to make mistakes. I think everybody needs to remember the last five governors of the Bank of Canada, plus Macklin is number six, all attempted to raise interest rates. during their terms. All five of the previous Bank of Canada governors attempted to raise interest rates. I use those five because that was when my career started in 1987, when John Crow took over the helm of the Bank of Canada. Every single one of those governors failed. They attempted to raise them, and then they had to give in and reduce them again. Every single one. There have been five attempts during my career the housing market. They have all failed. TIF is number six.
Could real estate cause debt bubbles to burst?
Debt bubbles are a myth. It's another myth created pre-2005 based on a seller-beneficial home trading infrastructure in Canada. Okay? The metrics that they use to measure debt are a myth. When we measure debt from Canadian home buyers or Canadian homeowners, it's totally different than the way that you see it published in other charts. Could real estate cause debt bubbles to burst? No. Debt bubbles will continually to inflate. Will that inflation slow? Sure, it's slow, but it's not going to burst. If it bursts, I think what you're basically saying is your country will enter a depression and not a recession. I mean, currently we've got inflation at about 9%. So what that really means in a debt perspective is your debt is deflating by 9% for the sake of the argument. So if debt is not rising at 9%, then, and inflation is at 9%, then clearly your debt bubble is deflating. Okay? It's not going to burst unless we're willing to enter a depression. I can't see a Bank of Canada governor doing that. That said, since this is a once in history event, the national lockdowns of housing markets, national reopening of housing markets around the world, we all see what's going on in China right now, or at least you should be looking at what's going on in China right now, and has been for almost 8 months. Maybe a global devaluation of the housing stock, the global housing stock, could cause debt to decrease, but I think by all practical purposes, that would be the definition of a depression, not just a recession.
Can Canadian banks raise mortgage rates without a coinciding rise in the central bank rate?
Of course, they do it all the time. They've done it for the last 40 years. They raise them without rates going up, and they decrease them without rates going down. Right now, we've got about a 1.5% flexibility between what banks can do with the mortgage rates and what the central bank has established. If you go looking at the charts, I think right now we've got somewhere between 6.14, 6.49 at the big six banks, but your posted rates are substantially lower than that. So that means that full amount could be wiped up. Canadian banks could raise rates to 6.14% today without the central bank changing things one iota.
Where do you see Canadian home prices going from here?
Well, if the question is, where do I see Canada's house price inflation or house price illusion going, I see it continuing to be removed. I see it continuing to go down. It's going to go down already. As your local MLS systems see home buyers going out and purchasing cheaper homes, lower priced homes, your average price is going to drop. 60 days later, your real estate agents are going to be listing the next group of listings at that same reduced percentage. So how low can they go? Well, there's a sustainable price for every home in Canada. Prices will not drop below those sustainable price. It depends on which market you're in, depends on which type of home you're in, depends on the condition of your home, depends on a whole bunch of factors. But what I can tell everybody is they will continue to go down because we have only begun to record the increase in interest rates already.
Does the Vancouver market still have a significant effect on national home prices?
Does the Vancouver Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver still have a significant impact on the Canadian Real Estate Association national home price, average selling price? Yes. But you also have to remember that if that is that's a small market compared to the Greater Toronto Area market or the Greater Toronto Hamilton area. So your Vancouver market, because your trading rate was so rapid during 2017, yeah. Their share of the national sales increased drastically at that time. That was probably never going to happen again. I can't see your policy, your government leaders allowing foreign buyers to purchase those upper priced homes in the same magnitude that was going on during the immediately preceding that period and up to the point where your foreign buyer tax was implemented, especially that rush at the end. Remember when the Greater Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver got their jump in house price? That will not happen again. And I don't think that you're going to see very many people 2 years from now, relying upon housing market metrics from any trade association associated with real estate salespeople.
In the 2008 U.S. housing bust, the home prices in specific markets dropped substantially more than other markets. Could the same thing happen here in Canada?
Well, the higher something goes up, the quicker it goes up, the quicker it can go down, and the lower it can go down. And that's only just to get back to where it all began. So the U.S. housing bust, you can't compare the Canadian housing market to the U.S. housing market. This is another one of the frustrating things that you read. If you want to look at a housing market to compare to Canada, look to California. So the state of California has basically the same number of homes as the country of Canada. It has the same number of major CMAs. It has the same MLS infrastructure. Now it has a lots of other problems. Healthcare is not nationally funded in California. But in terms of a housing stock and in terms of realtors, Canada and California has always been, or at least for the last 40 years, the two comparable markets. Never confuse Canada with the USA. There are places in the USA where entire towns are vacant. We don't have that in Canada. There are places in the USA, like major city, Detroit for the sake of the argument, where there are large subdivisions that were vacant in 2008 because the auto industry had left long ago. We don't have that in Canada. Canada's housing stock is a top-tier housing stock, coast to coast. Canadians take care of their homes, coast to coast. Canadian families are supported by a national health care program, coast to coast. So we always have to be careful when we talk about Canada in the context of the USA. Look at it in the context of California. Will they be substantial? Well, it depends on how you measure substantial. Are you going to measure it by percentage change or dollar change? Because dollar change, there's already a substantial difference between what's going on with MLS average price in the Greater Toronto Real Estate Board and the Windsor-Essex Real Estate Board or Chatham-Kent or the Calgary Real Estate Board. We're already seeing a massive difference in dollar value change. So be careful the metric you're looking for. But all housing markets all move different in terms of dollar change. The only time that they've all moved in parallel in percentage change was this lockdown reopening period, and it's why every MLS system in North America will be under pressure over the next 3 years.
Is a normal home price 3.5 times the average income for a given area, and could we see that ratio again?
Is there a world where we're going to see the banks raise interest rates back up to 12 to 16%? And my answer is no. One of the most silly measures we've ever heard was the 3.5 times the average income to house price. That is a ridiculous calculation that was started in the 1970s and 80s by stakeholders in the home trading infrastructure that was totally seller supportive at the time. It was done to justify banks claiming 95% of your mortgage payment on a first-time buyer in interest. That's where that number came from, folks. It is way better to be owning a home on 8 times your average income when 15%, when you start off paying down 15% of your mortgage each month, or 50% of your mortgage payment is going towards the principal and only 50% is going towards interest. Would you really rather pay 5% towards principal and 95% towards interest? The only people who profit from that were banks and realtors and sellers of real estate. The only way you could convince a young home buyer to purchase, start out owning a home when interest rates were 12, 14, 16% were to come up with a new marketing gimmick called house price to income ratio. We never use that. What I'll tell you is this, Jim. For the last 40 years, first-time home buyers have been buying homes at 8 times their income to house price. In 8 times their income to debt price. Okay? That's how we view it. House price to income ratio doesn't matter. House price to mortgage interest paid does.
What signals do you look for when home prices are bottoming?
Don't be fooled by peak prices. In other words, if you're a seller, don't try to hit the week the prices peak. Pick the quarter, the 3 months, the 90 days. When you're a buyer, don't pick the week the prices are going to buy at bottom. Pick the bottom 12 weeks when it's going to bottom. How do you know that signal's happening? You've got to be reading the housing market. Now, I'm also going to tell most buyers that are listening, you shouldn't be waiting for the bottom to be reached, because that could take years. You need to move forward with your life. Everybody's different. You do need to be reading a housing market to understand where prices drop below what is something the amount of risk that you're willing to take on. In other words, if a house has dropped from 800 to 700 and it's going to drop to 5, maybe you're a family who doesn't want to take on that extra drop. Okay, that extra drop is something your family can't handle. Maybe you're only willing to take an extra $50,000 of drop. Okay, so then for you, you've got to really be watching for that bottom of the market. Now, signals that you're looking for the bottom of a housing market. Nope, I'm sorry, you're going to have to get someone else to tell you how you measure the bottom of a housing market.
We're hearing there's a 40-year cycle in real estate. That would put the last cycle at this point in the early 80s. But in this cycle, there are debt bubbles everywhere. Could we be in for worse real estate markets than in the early 80s?
No. Because we're starting out at low interest rates, right? Then you started out at high interest rates. There is no such thing as a 40-year cycle in real estate. So I know we're hearing these things. We're hearing all kinds of stories, Jim. You know, nobody has the data to prove it. Nobody could substantiate what their claims are. They're just coming up with all these ideas, right? I've heard this 40-year cycle many times in the past, but there's no paper where that's been peer reviewed or even a textbook where it's ever been proven. trading cycles last, generally speaking, 5 to 7 years. Banks, policymakers, governments can extend the trading cycle a little bit. In this case, we had a trading cycle that had ended in the February of 2019. Then we had COVID lockdown, which created a short window where few months where people couldn't buy houses because they couldn't get out and buy them. Then the market reopened and all that pent up demand had to be fulfilled. Then you had the multiplicity of how with sales causes that made sales accelerate even more. But that was a once in history event. That's never happened before, and it will never happen again, because certainly some economists are going to study this hard enough where they figure out what the real scam was that went on. The last cycle that we had in my history ran from first quarter 1989 through to the second quarter of 2010. That's how long that cycle actually lasted. But that was a period of declining interest rates over that period of time. We're now into a period of rising interest rates. So the cycle is going to be even shorter going forward.
Are big corporations buying up residential real estate and turning the properties into rentals?
Okay, this another myth, right? Look, folks, if big corporations were this smart, they would have been buying properties up when COVID had hit. All those people that couldn't sell their house because the markets were locked down and they were facing the possibility of owning two houses, they were told by CMHC and everybody else that house prices were going to plummet. Those corporations would have been buying the houses up then. Do you really believe that they waited till the peak of the market to begin buying up residential real estate? It's another story being told by people who don't have access to the data. Those big corporations should have been buying the trough, and they should have been entering the market when interest rates were at 1%. Where you could get a mortgage for 10 years at 1.99% in Canada at some time. They shouldn't have been, if they were so smart, they wouldn't be waiting till interest rates, mortgage rates were up at 5% and prices were still at peak. It just makes no logical sense. Look, the odd, landlord who owns one or two properties, they own more of your housing stock than any big corporation is ever going to own. Governments would stop in and stop them from buying up real estate if it happens. It's another false myth. It's another, idea that somebody came up with to try to get themselves some airway talking points.
Are central banks responsible for real estate booms and busts?
No, I would say that the MLS systems, the home trading infrastructure, is fully responsible for booms and busts, and that the central banks respond to those boom and bust periods, not the opposite way around. When the central bank responds, the central bank overplays their hand. They raise rates too high, or they don't raise rates enough. They raise rates too late, or they raise them too early. That's what exacerbates the size of the boom and the size of the bust. Let me explain it to folks this way. In Q1 2017, the OSFI instituted the mortgage qualification rate, which in a single instance, a single stroke of the pen, raised interest rates up to 4.59% or 5.14%. I can't remember exactly what it was at the time. Okay, that was the hugest, the most radical increase in interest rates in history, because that's a qualification rate is all that really matters. It wasn't until just last month that the full impact of that mortgage qualification rate was finally registered. Now, it would have been registered in 2019, but then, of course, we had COVID, so it didn't get registered now until this year. If you go back to March of 2017, and you check the average purchase price in Canada, and you inflation adjust it to the average purchase price in August of 2022, you're going to find that home buyers were spending the exact same amount of money. Central banks respond to boom and bust periods of the real estate market, and all they do is make it worse, but because they delay or lead with their responses, and the responses that they make are too great or too small.
Is a significant percentage of employment in Canada dependent on a strong real estate market?
What I'll say is this, you know, from how we see it, you know, the retail jobs in this country are at stake as a result of a real estate market. And they're really more at stake today than they ever have been, because when they disappear this time, they may never come back. This is a totally different environment. Amazon, Walmart's move into the online space. We have some real potential of permanent unemployment in the retail space. Your local restaurants, yes, they will lay off staff, but probably as the housing market recovers, that staff will be rehired. Government, I mean, most of our employment that has taken place since COVID has been government employment. You know, I don't know how much longer taxpayers can bear the weight of the size of the government that we have today. I don't know. What I do know is this. As home equity wealth decreases, Canadian households spend less money. The less money spent, the less tax dollars collected. Less tax dollars collected means you get a bigger deficit. I'll leave it to people who are smarter than me to determine what happens with employment from that stage forward.
How do buyers and sellers tend to react in an ongoing rising interest rate environment?
Oh, beautiful question. Simple. Buyers buy lower priced homes. That's right, folks. As interest rates rise, your bank calls you and tells you, oh, you know that mortgage you qualified for of $500,000? Now it's only $400,000. You can't buy a $500,000 house anymore. You have to buy a $400,000 house. So you go out, instead of buying a semi-detached home, you buy a townhouse. Or instead of buying a two-bedroom condo, you buy a one-bedroom condo. That's right, you buy a cheaper house. Your local real estate agents, as a result, say, oh, the average price has decreased. 60 days later, when they're listing the next group of listings, they list them at that reduction the average price has taken into account. Yes, folks, it worked on the way up, and it's got to work on the way down. There is no way for your local organized real estate to extract themselves from this situation.
Following a real estate bubble, how difficult is it for realtors to get their clients to accept offers that are fair in today's market but not yesterday's?
It's really difficult for 99.9% of the realtors. Okay, there's about 0.1% of the realtors who have gained the trust and the level of incompetence that is required to get a seller to catch a dropping knife that is covered in butter. You have to have a high skill volume as a realtor to be trusted enough that a seller will reduce the price in their property enough to make it the most attractive property on the market at that priced category. Very, 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 very few realtors have that kind of trust. Their clients have that kind of trust in them. As a result, it's very, very, very difficult for 99.9% of realtors to get those price reductions. Those 99.9 are the follower realtors. So after the leading realtor that's trusted gets their client sold, then it's the other 99.9% who have to reduce their price to what that realtor just got. Sadly, the butter is so slippery, the knife is dropped even further towards their big toe.
If you were a realtor now, what would you do to generate income?
Well, what I would have been doing is over the last 2 years, I would have been generating trust with my clients, and I probably would not have sold, let them trade up, to a house over the last 2 year period because I knew what was coming going forward. I would have spent a tremendous amount of time over those 2 years not making money, telling them not to buy. That's what I would have done. At the same time, anyone who wanted to sell, I would have been working with them to get their house listed at the peak time to list it, which was Q1 in most parts of Canada, Q1 of 2022, and liquidate their real estate at that time. Let some other foolish realtor sell their buyer client. That's what I would have been doing. So to come out now and say, what should they do to generate income? There's nothing they can do. They've missed the window. They had 2 years to prepare themselves for this day. But 99.9% of them would not have done it. They would have taken the easy commission as they've gone through. What I will say is this. Since over 50% of the members of the Canadian Real Estate Association will earn less than minimum wage this year, if you want to generate income as a realtor right now, you should probably go out and get a full-time job at McDonald's or anywhere, or Lowe's or anywhere else. They're looking for employment right now because you're going to make more money working there than you are ever going to make it in organized selling real estate. That's probably going to go as high as 70% this year. It's better for you to go out and get two full-time jobs. Well, that's probably 80%. Two full-time jobs, work 60 hours a week at two jobs, and you will take home more income than you would have as a working realtor. So that's, since I think it's important that I give advice to the most number of realtors that need to hear it, that's the job that you should be doing, folks. If you're a realtor and you weren't trading at least 12 homes a year over the last year, you need to get out and get another job.
The Trudeau government is welcoming over 400,000 immigrants a year. Could these immigrants and foreign buyers help keep real estate markets in Canada afloat?
No. So we are into a correcting housing market now. So in terms of, you know, the myth that you're going to hear from your local real estate boards and every other the banks, anybody who wants to make a profit from a trade in real estate, they're going to come up with this. Oh, but we're taking on 400,000 new immigrants. That's going to be 1.2 million new Canadians over the next 3 years. Yes, that's true. But then why don't they cite the reports from CMHC from the 80s and 90s about how immigrants buy homes? Why don't they cite those reports? Because we've got a window of opportunity here for most Canadians because our immigration market was shut down for about that 1 year there. That is going to create a window of opportunity for Canadians, okay? As the new immigrants become Canadians, then they're going to be putting pressure on the home trading market again. I think we all have to ask those Canadians, like, this is a question I really don't like because I think it's totally unethical to welcome 400,000 new immigrants to this country without adding a minimum 120,000 backyards on top of the number of backyards existing Canadians already are demanding. I think it's an unethical thing. I don't know how any government can do it. It's not only not fair to Canadians by forcing those lower and lower and lower on the income grid to be pushed out of home ownership or certainly out of ever owning a backyard and welcoming in some new immigrants at the same time who may themselves never even have an opportunity to own a home in Canada because the government refuses to build enough houses, specifically add enough backyards.
So far, is this real estate downturn in Canada hitting the hardest in rural, suburban, or city areas?
It's hitting them all the same, Jim. They just don't know it. This is a pattern that follows over trading cycles over and over again. You notice the last markets to get hot were the rural markets or the outlying suburban markets, like the suburban markets far away from the prime city in your province. Those are always the last ones ever to heat up. They're also the ones to get hit the hardest. Anyone looking for great stories about this only needs to go back to the Muskoka period of the early 1990s, where all the celebrities like John Candy, Wayne Gretzky, Goldie Hawn, Dan Aykroyd, they were all, Muskoka was the talk of California at the time. And it was never going to go down again. Well, we all know what happened. They took the biggest hit in the province over the next 5 years.
Is it true the value of real estate in Canada has already dropped over $300 billion in value?
$300 billion, what's that, about $25,000 per house? I think that's what that works out for, Jim.
Yeah.
Would have Q1 2022 was peak price, right? Q1 22 would have been peak price. So I know that, you know, everybody's going to run away from those peak price readings now. But in all fairness, we are now back to 2017 prices, Q1 2017 prices. I think the drop, Jim, is actually around $1.5 trillion. Canadians today versus Q1, if all the, every Canadian homeowner in Q1 2022 went out and had their home appraised, and then they all went out and had their home appraised today, Canadians would be $1.7 trillion poorer. Why have you not read that anywhere? $1.7 trillion poorer based on Q1 pricing, appraised value, versus right now, appraised value of their homes.
Ross, actual home sale dates and home sale reported dates can be months apart. How accurate are monthly real estate stats?
Monthly real estate stats are not accurate. They have never been accurate. They have never been implied to have been accurate. They are pre-2005 statistics created for the benefit of sellers. That's all that they are. There has not been a new monthly real estate stat released to the public since 2005. Pre-2005, it was illegal to represent buyers in the country of Canada. That means every statistic that was ever created up until that date had a legal requirement to support sellers getting the highest price possible for their home. It didn't matter what that statistic did. It didn't matter how it manipulated the data. That was the only goal of those statistics. No new statistics have been released since 2005. No statistics released monthly are accurate. There are actual rules and regulations within organized real estate that prevent the old metrics from the 80s and 90s, which real estate agents used themselves, but could never say publicly because you weren't working for buyers, from being released to the public. They have never been released in the history of organized real estate. I really wouldn't want to have been one of those realtors who was selling homes after COVID without telling your buyer clients how skewed real estate monthly stats are towards sellers.
Ross, how can people follow you?
No sense following me, folks. We have pretty much moved on to working exclusively with the buyer side of real estate. Some of the buyers may take years before they acquire a home. You can go to thewealthyhomeowner.ca. If you're a buyer, and you can see about joining one of our programs there. If you're an existing owner and you're looking to trade up, you're still a buyer, so that's what it is. Our relationship with those we're advising now, some of it's gone on for years. I mean, we have many that are that are over three decades. So if you're looking for that, in terms of if you're just a consumer, it's thewealthyhomeowner.ca. If you're a financial advisor, someone who's needing housing market intelligence for knowing that you should have sold your bank stocks on February the 17th, or certainly take your pick during Q1, because our call was Q1. I say February the 17th only because that's the middle of the quarter of 2022, and you should have bought Dollarama stock the next day. You can reach us at rosskay.com. So
Ross,
that's it.
Thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jim. Glad to be back.
My guest has been Ross Kay, founder of Ross Kay Home Ownership Advisors, online at rosskay.com. He was speaking to us from Burlington, Ontario. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, John Rubino, and Ross Kay. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.